Hi, my name is Peter, and I'm a prophet in the new novel, American Prophet. I prophesied a natural disaster, a pandemic, and that crazy election. Now there are conspiracies about me. A dude is shooting at me, and the president is threatening me. My story is on Amazon, Audible, and Apple Books. Check it out. Just look for American Prophet by Jeff Fulmer. That's American Prophet by Jeff Fulmer.
Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Katie Halper.
I'm Mary Matte. Hey, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us. There's so much content out there, and yet you're choosing us. We're very grateful.
So nice.
And we're especially grateful to everybody who supports us at usefulidiotspodcast.com. You keep the show going. And for doing so, you get all kinds of bonus content, including the extended interviews we do every week, and also the Thursday Throwdown, your midweek dose of media madness.
Really encourage people to do that. And Aaron, you've been changing backgrounds a lot. Are you on the road?
I am on the road. And I have a story I want to tell. You know how some people, when they have like sizable Twitter followings, they'll try to exploit that with like by like asking an airline to be upgraded to like to like business class or whatever. Or they complain about how they were treated, you know, in the hopes of probably getting like an upgrade for a future flight. Sure. I don't do that. But I will use this podcast, Katie, if you don't mind, as my sounding board for travel complaints, if you don't mind.
No, of course.
And I don't think this will get me any upgrades on any airline. This has to do with the Marseille airport in France, where I just was, okay? So I'm in the male bathroom, and, you know, in the male bathroom, you have two choices. You have the urinal, and you have the stall with the door, right?
Right.
And I just had to go number one, but the thing is, all the urinals were occupied, so I went into the stall. And because I'm just going number one, I don't feel the need to close the door, right? Like, you know, I'm just in and out. Okay.
Okay.
So anyway, I go on the stall. I do exactly what I would do at the urinal. I do a number one. I leave. As I'm like halfway down the hall, I get a tap on my shoulder, and it's a security guard. And he goes, Monsieur, il faut fermer la porte quand vous allez à la salle de bain. Okay, which means to translate from my wonderful French. When you go to the bathroom, you have to close the door. So I say back to him in my broken French, I say, well, I didn't need to close the door given the nature of what I was just doing. I was just urinating, right? You have to close the door. I think, and he did not agree. So we got into a little argument about that. But I was shocked, first of all, A, at his opinion to begin with, that you have to close the door if you're just, you know, doing exactly what you do in a urinal. And second of all, they feel compelled to come down and chase me down and tell me that.
Wow.
Like, this is what a security guard is like doing at the Marseille airport. Is that what they're concerned with?
Imagine if a terrorist attack had taken place right when he was pursuing you. That would have taught him his lesson.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. No, I mean, it's an interesting philosophical question. I agree, though. You are basically using a stall as a urinal. And if you're allowed to be exposed the way you are at a urinal, obviously, that's not problematic.
Exactly right. Is there something special about urinating in a stall that requires you to close the door?
Right.
That obviously you would not be able to do if you were just at the urinal. It just doesn't make any sense to me. But this security guard was so offended by that, you know, he chased me down to tell me that. You know,
did he let you go? He didn't detain you though, right?
I was not detained. No, I was not detained. I was able to exit safely. Although, actually, funnily enough, after that happened, my flight got canceled.
Wow. Coincidence?
So actually, maybe the security guard, you know, really to show me what engineered that.
Maybe it just really put you down as a threat.
Yes. Yes. So anyway. Well, lesson not learned, sir, because I will continue to not close the door.
You'll probably never close the door now. You'll go out of your way to not close it. Yeah.
Yes.
Now, do most people close the door when using the stall?
Well, I don't know. Right. I don't know what people are closing the door for, but I can certainly recall many.
Like, have you seen people being in a stall with the door open?
I certainly have. Yes, okay. I think so. Unless, you know, I'm engaging in some cognitive bias here where I think I have. Right.
Yeah.
But because I'm so not committed to my position that I'm delusional.
Confirmation
I'm,
bias. Right.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Interesting.
Anyway, the point is.
Let us know, people.
Yeah. Let us know. But also the point is really useful idiots. We give you politics. Sure. Right. We give you culture, pop culture, but we also give you profound philosophical debates for you to ponder throughout the rest of your week. So there you go.
Well, thank you, Aaron, for sharing. All right. Well, I mean, I feel like everything after this is going to be kind of a letdown, but I guess we should nonetheless give people the four basic food groups. So I'll start with Democrats suck. And we have a moving story about AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, hosting a discussion on anti-Semitism with two interesting guests, Amy Spitalneck, who is the CEO of the JCPA, which is a lobbying group that is pushing for the definition, the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, which of course says that criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic, and people want the U.S. government to use the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism. The other person was Stacey Burdett, who also works for the JCPA and worked for the Anti-Defamation League for over 20 years. So let's hear what Amy Spitalneck had to say about the anti-Semitism on the left.
What's harder for us as progressives to recognize or understand is when anti-Semitism shows up and is normalized in our own spaces. And I want to be frank here. There is very real anti-Semitism that is in fact showing up in progressive spaces right now. And it's deeply painful and hurtful to Jews. As has been said, criticism of Israel, Israeli policies and its government, it's not inherently anti-Semitic. And the majority of people, students and others showing up to protest are there to speak out for Palestinian rights, not because they intend to be anti-Semitic.
Okay, so note what she does there. She says that criticism of Israel is not inherently anti-Semitic, right? And also, most people don't intend to be anti-Semitic when they're engaging in criticism of Israel. The implication there is that they are often being anti-Semitic, though bless them, bless their hearts, they don't realize it.
But we've seen the line into direct harm against Jews repeatedly crossed in recent months. And over the last 8 months, in certain ways, for me, it's been almost more personally painful to see what's happening in my own progressive community than, for example, what I saw in Charlottesville, because it's happening in my own community.
Poor Amy. I want to really hold this space for her and recognize her pain and her hurt. I think it's a great way to honor Heather Heyer, who was killed, of course, by an anti-Semite in Charlottesville when he drove his car into a crowd. The fact that she thinks that calling for a free Palestine or criticizing Israel is the equivalent or actually more painful than what we saw in Charlottesville, where Heather Heyer was killed and where people were chanting Jews will not replace us and holding torches, is so disrespectful and so ridiculous and outrageous. Like, how dare she make that comment? And this whole thing was kind of very misleading, because the shtick was kind of like, yeah, anti-Zionism isn't always anti-Semitic, but we're going to lay out for you where it is. When in fact, they were basically making the case that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitic. And not just that, it's more painful than what we saw in Charlottesville.
I'm done with all these discussions of anti-Semitism and trying to have it both ways, trying to pretend as if, yes, I'm critical of the government of Israel, but the anti-Semitism in progressive spaces has to stop. There's no more room for that. Like, yeah, it's over. Like, it's done now. Everyone with their eyes open can see that Israel is a Jewish supremacist, mass murdering regime. And anybody who can't call that out and is trying to find some middle ground where you can have it both ways, where you can pretend to have some criticisms of Israel while still not being aligned with those who are out there putting themselves on the line to protest Israel, like, it's not progressive. Don't call yourself
right.
a progressive.
Yeah, you're not progressive. Right. That's the truth. You're just not progressive. Yeah.
Yeah. Go and join Chuck Schumer and like the corporate Democrats.
Right.
And AOC catering to these people with, you know, Katie, you actually made a great point on Twitter. And let's actually pull up your tweet, because I really appreciate what you said about conflating criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism.
Yeah. Well, I think, you're talking about this tweet that I wrote in response to AOC. Please don't conflate anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. This conflation is, in fact, anti-Semitic and trivializes actual anti-Semitism.
Yeah, and this is after AOC, after not just doing this, like, you know, ridiculous video seminar about the anti-Semitic progressives protesting mass murder. Then she went and attacked protesters who were demonstrating against this exhibit in New York, this really callous, disgusting exhibit, trying to exploit the atrocities that happened at the Nova Festival on October 7th. To manufacture support for Israel's mass murder campaign in Gaza. And in that exhibit, there's some outright genocidal statements that are like presented in the name of like healing. Like, we have to heal for the victims of the of the atrocities at the Nova Festival. But really, it's all just an excuse, as all these things are, just to launder Israeli narratives and justify Israel's mass murder rampage in Gaza. And AOC is attacking the protesters who are out there against that and calling them anti-Semitic. So thank you, Katie, for calling her out for conflating anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism, because on top of just how disgusting it is to weaponize anti-Semitism to justify atrocities, a Jewish supremacist regime, it also actually contributes to anti-Semitism, as you said, because it conflates the state of Israel with Jewish people like us. Right. And there's no more place for that. And I have to wonder, why is AOC doing this? Like, what compelled her to do this? Like, is she looking at Jamal Bowman and the struggles he's having right now, where like AIPAC's funneling tens of millions of dollars to defeat him? Hillary Clinton is coming out against him, endorsing his opponent. And is she wondering, you know, she wants to put this up as like a way to defend herself from attacks like that? This isn't the way to do it. I'm sorry, because she's throwing people who are protesting mass murder under the bus. Or, I mean, more cynically than that, is she doing this to like give herself cover for if she runs for even higher office one day? And she can point back and say, look, I spoke out against anti-Semitism on the left.
Right.
But there's just no, you know, for anybody who takes progressive values seriously, there's no more room for this. Either you're for apartheid or you're not. Either you're for mass murder or you're not. Either you're for occupation or you're not. And there's no middle ground. There's no world in which criticizing any of that is inherently anti-Semitic.
Right.
It's only anti-Semitic if you're actually being anti-Semitic.
Yeah, right, exactly.
You have to explain this distinction every single week.
Every single time, yeah. So I wanted to show another clip from this with Stacey Burdett, who, as I mentioned, worked for the ADL for 24 years and also works like Amy. Amy's the CEO, but but Stacey also works for the JCPA, which is the Jewish Council for Public Affairs. So Stacey gives this whole spiel all about anti-Semitism and conspiracy theories and the Nazis, and then here's how she wraps it up.
Conspiracy theory shows why anti-Semitism punches up at us sometimes and down at us other times. We're outside invaders or infiltrating because we're the ultimate insiders. And I guess we can talk about it later, but in the very recent history of thousands of years of this hatred, think about how the introduction of a Jewish country can figure into that hate system. So I just wanted to set a frame for why anti-Semitism isn't just hating people because, you know, they celebrate their Sabbath on the wrong day. So thank you.
So here what she's doing is saying, well, we should just think about, just putting it out there, think about how the first Jewish state fits into this system of hate. And anti-Semitism isn't just hating people for their Sabbath. It's very clear that she's saying opposing this state is anti-Semitic and part of a hate system.
Yeah. So like, if I don't support, like, say, you know, stealing people's homes, which is what Israel's done since its inception, and enforcing them to flee, and committing ethnic cleansing, which was, you know, how Israel was founded, and then occupying people with the longest running military occupation in the world, and then committing mass murder and committing a starvation siege, I first have to, before I criticize any of that, I have to think about how me criticizing that plays into anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
You know, and also Israel loves anti-Semitism. They need it to survive because the only way they justify their existence as like this haven for the Jewish people, which of course they're not, is by fomenting anti-Semitism around the world. They love it. They want to be the victims. It's their entire victim mentality. So she's talking there about like the sort of insidious nature of the of people who criticize Israel, what they're playing into. She's projecting it's Israel and its supporters that manufacture that dynamic. They need to be victims. They need to be constantly facing anti-Semitism to justify what they're doing, which is occupying, displacing, besieging, and stealing the indigenous people of that land. The fact that she used to work for the ADL, like, what is,
should be
what
disqualifying.
That's a hate group. They're like, they pretend to be an anti-defamation league, but they're really an anti-Palestinian group. They're just, like, they're bigots. And actually, they have a long history of attacking anybody who supports Palestinian rights, including Black people, people of color. It's just like,
They call JVP, Jewish Voice for Peace, a hate group.
Yes, the head of
Jonathan Greenblatt,
called them a hate group, also called them a proxy for Iran.
Right. You know? I think that having a discussion about anti-Semitism right now is not inherently problematic, because I think it can show actually how we have to be speaking out against Israel and how we have to be distinguishing between Israel and Jews, or we're actually being anti-Semitic. But if you want to talk about this, like AOC, you should talk to people at Jewish Currents or something, or Jewish Voice for Peace.
Yeah. Okay, you know, I disagree slightly. I think we're Jewish people are among the most privileged people in the world. And seeing all the power they wield, like the Jewish billionaires wield, like getting university presidents fired, encouraging crackdowns on students, getting people fired from jobs. I'm ready to talk about anti-Semitism after the Israeli occupation has ended. You know, that's
my point is more strategic, honestly. I think that we can get people who are otherwise maybe wouldn't join it. I'm not making a moral argument, more of a strategic one. But so, yeah, we can agree to disagree on that. I agree with you, Aaron. I just think that if people feel like they need to address this, you don't do it with someone from the ADL and from a Jewish organization, Jewish Council for Public Affairs, that's working to get the IHRA adopted. Because you are perpetuating anti-Semitism when you conflate being a Jew with being a Zionist.
Well, I hope AFT is listening.
Yeah. All right, Aaron, what do we got for Republican suck?
All right. This one's a little cheap because, like, this guy's so easy. It's such an easy Republican suck. I didn't dig too deep for this week because Lindsey Graham, everybody, he's such a reliable source of Republican suck because everything he says is nuts. So here he is expounding on all kinds of topics, Vladimir Putin, Ukraine, and, of course, why we have to keep backing Israel's mass murder campaign in Gaza.
Our poll out today shows a majority of Americans, 61%, say the U.S. should not send Israel weapons. 6 in 10 says Israel should stop or decrease its military actions in Gaza. Isn't it time for this war to end now, given that the tide of public opinion is turning against Israel?
I think it'd be the biggest mistake we could. I criticize Senator Turbeville for his view of Ukraine. Let me be straight with you. Hamas would kill everybody here if they could get here. Israel's not our enemy. They're our ally. Well, they can't because they're pinned down over there. I want them destroyed so they can never come back to hurt Israel or us. Hezbollah is alive and well. So to those Americans who believe pulling the plug on Israel now makes us safer, you've missed a lot. Radical Islam wants to slit the throat of every Jewish person and your throat too. So no, I want to give weapons they need. The administration's withholding weapons. Trump was a great ally of Israel. If he wins this election, he'll have another great ally. I appreciate what President Biden's doing, but it's all been so slow. So if you don't, Iran, here's the big takeaway from my trip. The IDF chief told me he's never been more worried about a nuclear breakout regarding the Iranians than he is right now. He thinks we've lost deterrence. He's asking for joint military operations with the United States to convince Iran not to dash toward a nuclear weapon. These are the most dangerous times since the 30s. Don't make the mistakes of the 30s. Senator Turbeville said, give Putin what he wants. Yeah. Well, that's what we did in the 30s. That didn't work out. Pull the plug on Israel. That didn't work in World War II. It's not going to work now.
All right. So there's a lot there in a very, you know, short clip, about a minute and change. But he's saying that basically not only is Russia Hitler, but so is Hamas, and they want to slit the throats of every single Jewish person, really every single person. And if we don't help Israel slaughter people in Gaza, then some of them are going to fight Hamas over here. And then he says that, according to the IDF, they want to have a joint operation with the U.S. against Iran, which is kind of breaking some news there. I'm not sure if the IDF wanted that to be made so public, but Lindsey Graham obviously is on board with all of that. Let me just say, as a Jewish person who has visited Gaza before, nobody wanted to slit my throat. I was treated very well. People did ask me, though, including young children, basically they wanted help ending the occupation of their land. And that's
Aaron,
something
did that make you, did that hurt your feelings? Was that painful for you?
Yes, I accused all the children of Gaza of anti-Semitism because they don't like being occupied. So
how
I felt
do you think it fits into that system of hate?
Yes, exactly.
Is it worse than Charlottesville for you?
Yeah, honestly, AOC should have a dialogue between like those people she had on and the children of Gaza and ask, like, ask her experts to tell the children of Gaza why they're anti-Semitic.
Yeah. How they tell them they need to check their Palestinian privilege.
But Lindsey Graham, I mean, anyway, just unhinged warmongering, everything's Hitler, 1930s. Let's go to war with Iran. Let's arm Ukraine to the teeth, even though Ukraine is being decimated every time we do that. And of course, if we don't somehow keep mass murdering Palestinians in Gaza, then we'll have to fight Hamas over here.
Right.
Just like we'll have to fight Russia over here, too, if we don't keep arming Ukraine.
Slitting the throats, my God. Well, for isn't that weird? Let's turn to a story that's actually near and dear to my heart. As people may know, I really hate sharks, and I think there's a lot of sharkaganda out there. And who would have known that on this issue, I actually shared the same perspective as Donald Trump? Here's Donald Trump making an interesting speech. And Aaron, it kind of reminds me of what you brought up at the beginning of the show, because it raises a real philosophical question, much like your bathroom stall open door policy raised a philosophical question. So here he is talking about kind of a Sophie's choice, if you will, that takes place on a boat.
So I said, let me ask you a question. And he said, nobody ever asked this question. And it must be because of MIT, my relationship to MIT. Very smart. He goes, I say, what would happen if the boat sank from its weight and you're in the boat and you have this tremendously powerful battery and the battery's now underwater and there's a shark that's approximately 10 yards over there? By the way, a lot of shark attacks lately. Do you notice that? A lot of shark. I watched some guys justifying it today. Well, they weren't really that angry. They bit off the young lady's leg because of the fact that they were not hungry, but they misunderstood who she was.
He's calling out shark apologia, and I thank him for that.
People are great. He said there's no problem with sharks. They just didn't really understand a young woman swimming. Now it really got decimated, and other people too. A lot of shark attacks. So I said, so there's a shark 10 yards away from the boat, 10 yards or here. Do I get electrocuted? If the boat is sinking, water goes over the battery, the boat is sinking. Do I stay on top of the boat and get electrocuted? Or do I jump over by the shark and not get electrocuted? Because I will tell you, he didn't know the answer. He said, you know, nobody's ever asked me that question. I said, I think it's a good question. I think there's a lot of electric current coming through that water. But you know what I'd do if there was a shark or you get electrocuted? I'll take electrocution every single time. I'm not getting near the shark.
I mean, I think it's a really interesting question, and I agree. Although I think electrocution is probably a more inevitable death, but I don't want to go down with sharks.
I'll say this, in terms of esoteric tangents at campaign rallies, Trump has got Biden destroyed. I mean, you don't see that kind of talk at Biden rallies. He barely knows where he is, and Trump is going deep on really, you know, what are you going to say about them? They're off the beaten path. They're interesting topics.
Think outside the box.
Think outside the box. You know, it's creative. It's great. It's creative thinking. And I guess it's better than what he usually says, with, you know, which is threatening war with everybody and bashing immigrants. I'd rather hear him expound on sharks. And
I'd rather hear him, bash sharks. It's hard to say bash sharks.
And speak out against sharkaganda.
Maybe if he focused on that, he could actually get my vote.
By the way, when he talked about his deep ties with MIT, is he talking about Jeffrey Epstein?
That's a good question.
You know, Jeffrey Epstein had deep ties to MIT. Or he's probably talking about his uncle, who was a professor at MIT, who he loves to invoke to claim he's smart. But anyway, fascinating questions there from Donald J. Trump. Good for him for stumping a ship's captain. You know, you don't hear that every day.
Definitely, yeah.
All right, for Isn't That Terrible, we're going to check in on the Ukraine proxy war, see how things are going. Now, the Biden administration has taken a bunch of steps of late that they had previously ruled out because they deemed them to be too dangerous when it comes to confronting Russia. So many times now, the Biden administration has said, we're not going to do this in Ukraine, but then they end up doing it because Ukraine just keeps getting decimated. And out of desperation, the Biden administration says, okay, fine, let's do this. So they've sent a bunch of weapons they previously had ruled out. They ruled out cluster munitions. They ruled out ATACMs. They ruled out letting Ukraine strike Russia with U.S. weapons. But recently, they've done all those things because things are going so bad for Ukraine. Well, now they're taking another step. Now they're going so far as to arm Ukrainian militias that they previously refused to arm because they were neo-Nazis. But now, with Ukraine running out of people and running out of time, the Biden administration is saying, you know what? Let's go ahead and arm the neo-Nazis. So here's the headline from the Washington Post. U.S. lifts weapons ban on Ukrainian military unit. The decision was made following a State Department review of the Azov Brigade, a one-time militia now part of Ukraine's National Guard. Now, for people who don't know who Azov is, they are a militia that was formed in 2014 after the U.S. backed a coup in Ukraine, and a war broke out between the new coup government and Ukrainians in the east with the backing of Russia, who are rebelling against the new coup government, in part because the new coup government basically wanted to wipe out or crack down seriously on Russian culture inside of Ukraine. And many people in eastern Ukraine didn't like that and didn't like the overthrow of the government that they voted for and didn't like the fact the U.S. was involved in that coup. And so the Azov Battalion was formed as a militia on the front lines to fight the eastern Ukrainians who rebelled. And the Azov Battalion particularly does not like Russians and is also was founded by people who are neo-Nazis. So their founding commander is a guy named Andrei Beletsky. And this is what he once said, according to the Washington Post. Ukraine's purpose is, quote, to lead the white races of the world in a final crusade against semi-let Untermenschen, which means inferior races. And his supporters called him white ruler, okay? So that's Beletsky. He's the founding commander of Azov, and he's actually still a high-ranking commander in Azov today. So after all this comes to light, the U.S. actually banned assistance to Azov.
Right.
John Conyers, the late Congress member, spearheaded this effort in Congress, and the State Department also restricted arming Azov because they're just, you know, they're led by an open neo-Nazi, right? Well, never mind that now. The Biden administration, which, you know, came to office claiming they oppose Trump's white supremacy, all that stuff, they have no problem right now arming an openly white supremacist battalion, which has now been incorporated into Ukraine's armed guard. And the excuses they're making are really funny. They're saying that the Azov that was led by a neo-Nazi and was banned for having white supremacist views, that's different than the Azov that they're arming now. This is what the State Department said on Twitter in response to Eric Sperling, who is the head of a group called Just Foreign Policy. And Eric Sperling is a former staffer for Congressmember John Conyers, who helped push through that legislation that banned Azov. And this is what the State Department said to Eric Sperling. Fact check for you, Eric Sperling. The U.S. government never provided support to the now disbanded militia known as Azov Battalion. In contrast, the 12th Special Forces Azov Brigade received arms and equipment after successfully completing necessary security forces vetting. So, I don't know. These Azov people who were vetted, did they read like Robin DiAngelo yep. or Ibrahim X. Kendi? I don't know. Let's go on with what the State Department said. Two key takeaways. The two units are not the same despite persistent Russian disinformation to conflate them. So the State Department is saying that, okay, you're talking about a different Azov, not the Azov right. that we're arming. But the problem is Azov, it says, openly says that it's the same unit that it's always that it always has been. It recently celebrated its 10-year anniversary. And so here, for example, is a tweet from Azov. So you see there, Azov, 10 years. Today, Azov is 10 years old. Tough battles are ahead of us. Azov is ready to receive them with honor. Glory to Ukraine, which is a slogan that has its origins actually in ultranationalist neo-Nazi Ukrainians. So anyway, that's Azov celebrating its own 10-year anniversary, contradicting the State Department, which said that Azov is different.
It's a new and improved Azov. Yeah,
new and improved. And it's different than the one we're arming. And anyway, that's what's happening now. That's how the proxy war is going. And as a bonus, here's one more indication of how badly things are going for Ukraine, but great for Western sponsors of the proxy war. Ukraine is so strapped for cash right now that they're going to be forced to sell off their state assets and basically privatize themselves, turn themselves even more over to Western neocons and corporations. This is the headline from the New York Times. Cash-strapped Ukraine plans to sell state assets to help fund war effort. You know, this is a longtime goal of neocons who, when they go into foreign countries, not only to use them against their, you know, adversaries like Russia, but also to turn them into client states beholden to Western investors so people can make a lot of money. This happened in Iraq after the Bush administration invaded. Remember, disaster capitalism, the shock doctrine, the term of Naomi Klein. Same playbook here. Ukraine's been turned into a U.S. proxy. So why not turn over the proxy's assets to Western investors? So all around, just a disaster.
Win-win. We'll get to see a lot of people killed and also see people ruined financially. What's not to love? And those are your four basic food groups. We hope you're full.
For this week's guest, we are joined by Daniel Levy. He is president of the U.S. Middle East Project and a former Israeli peace negotiator under the prime ministers Yitzhak Rabin and Ehud Barak, now a leading critic of the Israeli government. Daniel Levy, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure. Good to be with you.
As we're recording this, there is still a prevailing confusion about the state of the ceasefire proposal on the table. Hamas claims that it's accepted what the U.S. has put forward with some modifications. The U.S. says that Hamas's counterproposals are far too much of a departure from what is on the table. And they claim that Israel has accepted the U.S. proposal, even though Israeli officials say they haven't. So can you help us make sense of what is going on? What is your assessment of whatever the current ceasefire proposal is, and who do you see as being the main obstacle?
Yeah, I can try, but beyond a certain point, I'm also scratching my head. And so there has been a kind of Gordian knot where we have been stuck for months now. And at one level, it's pretty simple. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has said, I am committed to continuing to prosecute this war. He has set a number of unrealistic, unachievable war aims. And he has said, I'll have a pause. Sure, I can get my hostages out. And then I'm going to carry on with the war. And the Hamas position, but I think it would be a position that kind of any movement in that situation would take, has been, well, we are interested in a permanent ceasefire. The devastation that we have seen in Gaza means why would there be an interest in having a repeat, if people remember, of November, where you had a mass release of Israelis being held. It lasted 8 days. And then we saw what we've seen in the last months. So could you overcome that? On that May 31 speech, Biden seemed to lean into the idea that the US had gotten onto the page of a permanent cessation, of a sustainable calm. That seemed to be the news coming out of his appearance and the proposal that he presented. Okay, a few hours go by. It's the Sabbath, but that doesn't prevent Netanyahu with his ultra-religious coalition allies from going on his X account and tweeting that Israel kind of accepted the bits that it liked, but he repeats that he's committed to continuing the war. He clarifies that every opportunity in the intervening days and ever since, his coalition allies are even more categorical in saying, no, we refuse, we reject the deal. His own party, Likud ministers and lawmakers, do the same. The members of his war cabinet who support the deal, lots to say by way of criticism of Gantz and Eisenkot, those war cabinet members, but they're the ones who supported the deal. They quit the government. So here you have, and there's nothing subtle about this, right? The entire world has heard this Israeli position. But what are the Americans saying? What does the administration say? The administration keeps telling us, Israel has said yes. It's as simple as that. All eyes are on Hamas. We're only waiting for an answer from Hamas. And it's almost like they live in this twilight zone, as if the rest of us have been locked up and not been given access to anything else other than US officials' talking points. Hamas clarifies really what it had said all along, which is unless this is the on-ramp to a permanent ceasefire, we are not moving forward with it. So I think what you have here is, you know, did this begin as an attempt to put more pressure on Netanyahu to tease out the differences inside Israel in the hope that they may lead to getting an actual Israeli yes rather than the pretend one that they were talking about? I don't know. Was there this an attempt at constructive ambiguity that has a role in diplomacy? I see that. Maybe. But in the meantime, that's not where we are. And the continued American insistence and lying to us I don't see how this is getting us anywhere close to breaking the impasse. So one has to fall back on the conclusion that it's simply more comfortable for the administration to play the blame game, to be able to tell people, we tried, we're back in the place where Hamas is the rejectionist, even if that's not what we're seeing with our own eyes and hearing.
And meanwhile, you just had this interview with President Joe Biden, where he was asked by Time magazine, do you think it's fair to say that Netanyahu is prolonging this war for his own political self-preservation? And Biden, in a very typical gaffe, said, I'm not going to comment on that, but then immediately commented in the sentence afterwards and said, yes, I think one would be, it's a fair assumption to believe that. So, I mean, do you agree with Biden's second comment that Netanyahu is indeed prolonging this for his own self-preservation? And if so, where do you see him taking this assault, this slaughter in Gaza?
It doesn't exactly take someone with a phenomenal capacity for insight and depth of analysis of the Israeli political reality to draw that conclusion. I mean, it's demonstrably obvious to virtually anyone who's following events there, and yeah, the vast majority of the Israeli commentariat, only the kind of die-in-the-wool Bibi camp would say anything different. You have a prime minister who is facing court proceedings which could see him end up in jail. He needs to be in the prime minister's office. That is literally his get-out-of-jail-free card. He was prime minister when this occurred on October 7th. A huge disaster. And terrible, terrible things happened. He's the prime minister. He knows that when the war ends, he faces the music for that. He will have the commissions of inquiry. And so the war helps keep him in office. So it is not exactly a stretch to suggest that this is what one of the things, at least, that's going on. And I also do just want to caution against us getting kind of trapped in a place that does not accurately reflect Israel, which is, I call it kind of Bibiitis, where everyone just sees things through the person of the prime minister. This wouldn't be happening if it were just about Bibi. But nonetheless, that's big in Bibi's considerations, in Netanyahu's considerations. And so I think what we will see, unfortunately, is the continuation, the intensification of the Rafah operation. We're seeing other actions, of course, elsewhere in Gaza. At some stage, I do think just that the nature of the Israeli military mission, the degree of attrition, the need for respite for the reservists, for the Israeli troops, mean that you will again have a drawing down of troop numbers, but you'll maybe not see daily mass civilian killing events, but you'll continue to see very bad things happening. Under those circumstances, you won't get the kind of humanitarian aid and assistance in which is necessary after the destruction Israel has wrought. So in Netanyahu's schematic, this will go on for a long time. And I've not even touched on the provocations in the West Bank. And we see, you know, this constant uptick in killings of Palestinians in the West Bank. And as long as Gaza continues, it's going to be really tense. Israel, Hezbollah, Israel, Lebanon on that Israeli northern border.
So besides the self-serving motives behind Netanyahu, what is the ultimate kind of endgame plan for him and for Israel more largely? Because as he pointed out, this isn't just Bibi. So what is the vision?
Okay, so I think one has to divide it up a little bit, Katie, which is right now I'm not sure that they have, that Netanyahu has a plan of what his morning after looks like. To the extent to which there is an ongoing, that predates October 7th, of course, Israeli position, it's entrench the control, it's, you know, maximum land, and it's this matrix of domination which is going to prevent any Palestinian freedom rights, etc. There's nothing surprising in that. Right now, inside the governing coalition, I think, broadly speaking, you have two positions. And again, they've not really hidden them. So one position is Ben-Gvir Smotrich and a significant cohort of the Likud. I again insist, including much of the Likud, along with Ben-Gvir and Smotrich. I think people make a mistake when they just talk about those two ministers. This is a spectrum. It's not a hard divide, right? And what many of them are saying is we want the Palestinians out of Gaza. We want to resettle Gaza. You saw plans. They were out in the public domain by Israeli government ministries to push as much of the Palestinian civilian population of Gaza across into Egypt. You know, ethnic cleansing, displacement of Palestinians is hardly 2024 idea, right? What constitutes the Palestinian population of Gaza? Why do most of them live in refugee camps and have refugee status? These are people who were forcibly displaced during the Nakba. So the idea is push them out and resettle Gaza. Now, I think Netanyahu's position, and this is what he's articulated, and I think it's the position of many others in the government, the other camp in the government, if you like, is, well, we're not going that far, but Israel is going to maintain a military presence. Israel is going to militarily stay in and reoccupy Gaza. They say until the process of eliminating Hamas, and the word they have used is de-radicalization. Now, I understand there's the likelihood of confusion, so let me clarify it. Given all the videos and the images we're seeing coming out of Gaza, one might imagine that they mean de-radicalization of their own society. But for the sake of clarity, they don't. They mean de-radicalization on the Palestinian side. So that's the position of Netanyahu, which is kind of turning Gaza into a West Bank, into a Jenin or a Hebron, on steroids for an extended period of time. You have another position, which is that of the opposition, the opposition within the Zionist camp inside Israel, the centrist parties, if you like, Gantz, Lapid, etc. And what they seem to be saying is, Gaza war good, you know, no criticism of the war itself. But the problem is you don't have a plan for the morning after. I would suggest that their plan for the morning after is just as fantastical in the negative as in make-believe-y sense of the term, and unpleasant. Now they're saying, well, let's get the moderate Palestinians of the PA in with some Europeans and Arabs, and they can manage Gaza. And what they're essentially saying is, let's go back to the status quo ante, which is a regime, I think, accurately described by Palestinians, Israeli human rights NGOs, Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, and 25 states in their depositions at the International Court of Justice as meeting the bar of a legal definition of apartheid. So I think that's the spectrum from kind of apartheidists with a smiley face through to reoccupy Gaza permanently through to the expulsionist, eradicationist camp. I would probably find it very difficult to vote for any of those myself.
And speaking of potential outcomes, you have a quote that I thought was interesting. You said that the peace process is, quote, the refuge of scoundrels who want to maintain the status quo. What did you mean by that? And how does it apply to where we are right now?
Right. So first of all, I did an injustice to my previous answer, which is I failed to mention the there is a plan. I don't know who put it together, but it's put out under the name of the Israeli Prime Minister's office for Gaza Day After, which is these weird images of Gaza looking like a Gulf state with huge car production facilities. And the idea is you've raised the whole thing to the ground and now you can kind of build some kind of, it's not high tech, just a production hub there. There's a brilliant piece by Adam Tooze in his Substack, which I'd recommend to people, that talks about this. It's 2, 3, 4 weeks old by now. Okay, peace process, refuge of scoundrels. What I mean by that is that we have gotten accustomed to a diplomatic modus operandi where if you swear your fealty to two states in the peace process, then you're somehow on the good side and you've done your bit and you've kind of taken the necessary stand. It's a Potemkin peace process. It has been for an awfully long time. Last month, in May of this year, we actually marked the quarter century anniversary of the formal end of Oslo, in terms of the end date that the process set for itself to achieve an outcome on all issues. I was there, I was involved. The agreement that was reached, it was Gaza-Jericho first, was the first phase of the implementation of the Declaration of Principles signed in September of 1993 on the White House lawn with Yitzhak Rabin, Yasser Arafat, Bill Clinton. So in that agreement, it said upon entry of the beginnings of the Oslo implementation phase, you would have 5 years to resolve all those outstanding issues. That was May 4th, 1994. 5 years is May 1999. 25 years later is May 2024. Now that just doesn't work. And so what, and there's an argument over what was the intentionality behind Oslo. Was Oslo a way of rearranging the furniture of the occupation? Was Oslo always intended to get Israel into a place where it could move towards having a Palestinian Bantustan in place? Was there an evolution on the Israeli side which could have led to a breakthrough? We can't do the counterfactual history, and people can argue that one out. What we can do with a high degree of certainty is look at what has been the direction of travel and where are we today. And where we are today is that anyone who thinks that peace process is the way forward, that after all these years of backsliding and things getting so much worse, that this is the way to somehow deliver deoccupation, Palestinian rights, the undoing of apartheid, that's not serious. And so the description I used.
Daniel, as someone who was involved in the so-called peace process, I'm going to actually challenge you to answer your counterfactual, because you were there on the ground, and I think we have plenty of evidence of what was really at play. You had Rabin, the so-called, you know, father of the peace process on the Israeli side, saying shortly before he was assassinated by a right-wing Israeli that he foresaw a less than Palestinian state. He never wanted to grant Palestinians full statehood, and he explained that if we give Palestinians some limited autonomy, they'll, you know, handle policing themselves. We won't have to hear complaints from Israeli human rights groups about how we treat Palestinians. You had Shlomo Ben-Ami, the former foreign minister of Israel, saying that Oslo was founded on a neo-colonial basis. He also said that if he were Palestinian, he never would have accepted the Camp David peace offer in July 2000. So let me ask you, just from your own direct experience, I mean, was there ever any good faith on the part of the Israeli side to actually reach a sustainable peace outcome that could have respected minimal Palestinian rights?
Okay. First of all, yes, I set myself up for this question. secondly, Aaron, you see, what you said at the end there matters, which is this minimal Palestinian rights. So I think if the question is posed as, could Oslo have delivered justice for Palestinians, in particular in regard to justice with regard to the Nakba, for Palestinian refugees, the answer is very simple, and it's no.
Yeah.
Could you have had a development in which an Israeli leadership may have gone to a place which approximated deoccupation, which approximated something that could have resembled a state? I'm not comfortable with being so deterministic as to rule that out, but the crucial missing link here in the way that is often framed is Israel was not the only actor. And the PLO at that stage was a PLO that actually carried, I would argue, majority Palestinian support with it. It's not the totally co-opted Palestinian Authority of today. So I think one has to, what the PLO was demanding then. And of course, there were Palestinian critics and many of them who didn't go along with it and who correctly foresaw in retrospect, and maybe it was obvious at the time, where this would lead. But when you had a PLO that said, we are here to rectify the problem of 1967, and we're the ones who are going to say you can kick 1948 into the long grass, then the expectation on the Israeli side has to be judged accordingly. So that's why I'm saying that, you know, could you have had the undoing of the post-67 occupation and perhaps later on a Palestinian movement that said, but wait a minute, that's not what we were exclusively about. What about the structural discrimination of the Palestinian citizens of Israel? What about the internally displaced Palestinians in Israel? What about the properties taken, the land confiscated, compensation, restitution, the right of return? So could you have gotten to a place where 67 was resolved and 48 would have come back later? Look, that's not how it played out. So likelihood is no. For me, the thing that I've reflected an awful lot on over the years is, and this would speak to the bad faith on the Israeli side. The thing I've reflected a lot on is that Israel went into this with a very firm insistence that any agreement would say end of conflict and end of claims. And the end of claims is designed to close the door on the 48 files. Okay? And that wasn't what we were doing, because we were trying to sweep those under the carpet. And so, you know, did you have an insufficiently effective Palestinian negotiating team at the time? Was this an effort to say, well, let's just get what we can and then we'll see where this goes? But the thing that was never attempted throughout that peace process was to go into something that has been used in other conflict situations, which is this whole notion of transitional justice and truth and reconciliation. So that was never on the table. And to me, unfortunately, that means that the likelihood is that the conclusion we have to draw is that actual existing Zionism is incapable of coming to terms with those things, is incapable of taking on board what it would mean to actually deal with history, recognize Palestinian rights, make good on what was done to Palestinian refugees in any way that would be acceptable to Palestinians, and that this was built, therefore, on a very flimsy, and I'd go as far as to say dishonest, basis.
Listen, last question on this, because I agree that it's now sort of, it's in the past now. It's, the peace process is over and there's limited value in rehashing it. But I am curious, as I understand it, the PLO was willing to accept some symbolic compensation for 1948, but certainly was not insisting on the full right of return of all Palestinian refugees, but wanted some sort of acknowledgement of Palestinian suffering and the fact that Palestinians were displaced, contrary to the foundational myths of Israel. But that simply the Israeli government, whether it was under Labor or Likud, just was never going to do that, because to acknowledge the Nakba would be to acknowledge that Israel's foundational myth is just that, a myth, that it was founded on ethnic cleansing, and there's just no Israeli government was prepared to go there. And then when it comes to 1967, even there, Israel insisted on keeping the major West Bank settlement blocks without offering Palestinians an equal land swap inside 1948 Israel. And so therefore, even there, there was a similar refusal to, you know, grant Palestinians something that where they could say that they've gotten some recognition of their basic rights. Is that a fair assessment?
It is a fair assessment. And to the extent to which we ever went anywhere near that, there was language I was involved in Taba, which was the final negotiation in 2000 under the Barak government, when we were already in an election cycle. The historic record shows that Israel actually said, we have to stop these negotiations. We're about to go to an election. And the parties put out a statement saying they'd never got closer. The convenient propaganda recording of that is the Palestinians, as usual, walked away, turned down an offer, and all the rest of it. At Taba, there was language that moved on that refugee issue, and there was a land swap that moved on the territorial issue. I don't know if Barak even would have endorsed it. We never got there. You've never had an Israeli position which has come close to that. And even that position, I would align with the criticism that, you know, actually, if Israel thought that it could get 78% and other things, it should have grabbed that and been generous and thrown other things into the pot. And it just couldn't do that. And that, you know, that ultimately has to speak to something foundational, as you've suggested. So where does that leave us? That leaves us with nothing even close to that on the table today. And I think people who think that you could just go back to that and Palestinians could accept that now, sometimes you can rush to a deal, you get that deal in place, and it unravels. Sometimes you rush to a deal and then one side says, okay, there's plenty that should not have been conceded, and you revisit that. And sometimes you don't get the deal, and the deep inadequacies of what was being discussed get more and more exposed over time. And I think that's where we are on this. Look, the other thing is, this was a unipolar moment. If you're looking at when this happened in the 90s, so what else happens in the 90s? You actually see the end of apartheid in South Africa, right? So for all the inequities and structural inequality still today in South Africa, you saw Mandela walk free and you saw the apartheid regime end. For all the lack of finality on Northern Ireland, you actually saw a power-sharing deal, and you saw we have not gone back to anything like what Ireland was prior to the Good Friday Agreement. And that has not happened. Things have just gotten worse in Palestine, Israel. And, you know, I think a lot of that, and you can't understand the current situation unless you speak to the impunity that the U.S. granted Israel.
You just mentioned Israel's impunity. What is behind the United States' enabling of Israel? What does the United States hope to get out of it? And what does it get out of it?
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiotspodcast.com.
Well, very grateful to Daniel Levy sharing with us all of his insight and doing so at a very, very late time. So thank you, Daniel, for
him
staying up late to bless us with your knowledge.
Yeah, and that was great. What a get. I was so excited when I heard we were having him on. And you're definitely going to want to become members, if you're not already, subscribers to usefulidiotspodcast.com, because not only do we give you a great Thursday throwdown, but our extended interview with Daniel is pretty fascinating, and he touches on how he evolved from being someone who was in the IDF to the person he is today.
All right. Our website again is usefulidiotspodcast.com. Go there, support the show, keep us going. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
Bye.
Thanks so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For extended episodes, bonus content, and our weekly Thursday Throwdown episode, please subscribe at usefulidiotspodcast.com. Support the show for free by subscribing on YouTube, Rumble, and wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the podcast, don't forget to rate and review. You can also follow us on Twitter at Useful Idiot Pod. Thanks for supporting independent media. We'll see you next time.
Your child has so much potential, but your local schools may not be right for them. Check out K-12. K-12 powered schools are accredited tuition-free online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 2 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to learn more. That's k12.com/podcast.